Linda Porter studied history at the University of York and spent the early part of her career lecturing in the United States before changing paths to work in public relations at BT. Since leaving BT nearly 15 years ago, she has written 5 books on influential but often misunderstood figures in early modern British history, including Mary I and Catherine Parr. In this episode, she discusses her newest book, A Study of Charles II, His Mistresses, and the Making of the Modern British Monarchy. Thank you so much for joining me. I want to start off by asking you about your very interesting career trajectory. So you studied at York, and then you taught for almost a decade in the US, and then you spent over 20 years at BT before turning to writing history for a popular audience. So how did all of this happen?
Well, it of course didn't happen deliberately. It wasn't a trajectory I chose. It was my sort of reaction, I suppose, to events that had befallen me. But I went first of all to New York, to City University of New York, because when I was a graduate student at the University of York here, they had an exchange system with City University of New York. And I mean, dozens of City University of New York undergraduates had come over to York, quite literally, but CUNY had a pretty fearsome bureaucracy, I think, and somehow or other, no one had ever been able to go back the other way. And my university got rather fed up with this and said, you know, if you don't do something about this, we're going to stop this scheme. So they sort of scratched a few heads over in New York and said, OK, we'll offer 2 of your graduates, your postgrads, a year here on half assistant professor pay. And they can get some teaching experience, finish writing things and all that. And in those far-flung days, half assistant professor pay was quite a lot of money to me, you know, having just done a doctorate. I wasn't flush with money. The guy I was supposed to come over with, Mick Dury, eventually chickened out. He knew his girlfriend couldn't come with him. And so he decided he wouldn't go. Funnily enough, he ended up in Australia. Whether with a girlfriend or not, I don't know, but he's worked in universities there for many years and is now retired. So that was quite odd. But that was how I ended up in New York. And I taught, first of all, at Lehman College, which is at the campus of City University, right up in the northern part of the Bronx, which was pretty much of a culture shock for someone who'd been living in Paris, as you can probably imagine. And in those days, the South Bronx looked as though it had been hit by a nuclear strike. And it was really, I mean, it's been gentrified and gone up a lot since then. But in those days, it was just an absolute disaster area. Not so much in the north where Lehman was situated, but I taught courses on sort of early modern history, the Reformation and Renaissance and things like that. And I did live in New York for nearly 10 years. When I came back, my husband, who's American, though he's now a British citizen, came with me, and he took a considerable drop in salary, and so I needed to work full-time. And it was a very difficult time for academic jobs in the UK, and I applied for several but didn't get them, and then decided, you know, I had to change career and change direction. And my family on both sides had a long history of involvement with what was then still post office telecommunications, as it was called, going back to a great-grandfather who'd been a postman in rural Devon. And my father was still, he was within a year of retirement, and he said, why don't you take the entry exam? So I thought, oh my God, I really don't want to do this. On the other hand, it will pay me. And I did take it, and I was interviewed and was offered a job. I had to come in at the lowest management level, which wasn't terribly good for my morale, I suppose. But I eventually worked my way up into senior management and was there for nearly a quarter of a century, 22 years, until eventually I grew tired of sort of corporate infighting. And I thought I would like to go back to doing historical research and writing. And at about the time that I decided to leave, they were always happy to give people packages in those days, which were quite remunerative, and you could draw your pension and all that sort of thing. So it, financially, it made a lot of sense. But about that time, I had made a number of corporate videos for use internationally, because I worked in international corporate communications. And the guy that had directed and produced these for me, I said to him, look, you don't by any chance happen to know a literary agent, do you? Because I knew how very difficult it was to get published, especially in non-fiction, without an agent. That's a situation which hasn't changed, incidentally. And he said, well, as a matter of fact, I do, because he had just been working with someone on a particular script for a TV documentary, whose agent was the man who became my agent, Andrew Loney. And I got in touch with Andrew and said who I was and what I was interested in writing, which was then on the 18th century. And he said, well, here's what you need to do to put together a proposal, and it will have to cover X, Y, and Z. And for several years, we tried different things, to the point that I said, I'm fed up with this. You know, I will try one more and then I'm going to give up. Because it's quite soul-destroying to go through, you know, endless rejections, which happens to many authors, of course. And I sat around one day and I thought, I need to write about someone, possibly a woman, and it needs to be someone very well known, you know, no matter how fascinating. If no one's ever heard of them, a publisher will not pick it up. And I think my background in business helped, because I did have a feel for what would work commercially and what they might be looking for, certainly after several years of trying. And it needed to be someone who was very well known, who was controversial, and who hadn't been written about for a while. And all of a sudden, although I never had at that stage thought of myself as a Tudor historian, the name Mary the First, Mary Tudor, just popped into my mind one afternoon. And I thought, well, this is a possibility. So I did the research, I wrote a proposal, and my agent said, oh, but this is great, you know, it's got parental abuse, sibling rivalry, a failed marriage, you know, we can sell this. And sure enough, he did. He got several offers for it, and we took the highest one. And I've been writing nonfiction ever since. I switched publishers after my first book, not because I wanted to, but because my publisher was taken over. And it, you know, became apparent that the not invented here syndrome applied to quite a few of the authors they already had. And I then have stayed until my most recent book with Macmillan here in the UK. But that relationship has also just come to an end, sadly. Not of my making, I have to say, but for a very similar reason, because it is a new broom who sweeps clean. They have a new managing editor or publishing director or whatever you call them, and they're getting rid of a lot of their non-fiction people. I must admit, I had not anticipated this happening to me at this stage of my career, but you know, that's life, and you have to get accustomed to it. And it's given me the opportunity to think about going in another direction, which is perhaps to try my hand at writing historical fiction, because it's quite remunerative if it does well. I wouldn't have the pressure of a deadline, at least not initially. You can self-publish historical fiction fairly successfully, but I would never remotely consider trying to self-publish non-fiction. It's just the hiding to nothing. And whether I will get anywhere with it or not, I don't know. It calls for a completely different set of skills, or substantially different at any rate. I mean, underneath both, you do need to be able to write, fairly evidently. But for historical fiction, you need to be able to do plot, dialogue, and characterization. And in historical non-fiction, you have most of that laid out for you, if you think about it. The plot is, you know, written in the past, as it were, by what happened, even if you're analysing it and putting forward different theories about it. The dialogue is in diaries, letters, documents and what have you. The characterisation, I suppose, is perhaps an area where the two, fiction and non-fiction, have a bit of overlap, because historians do have the ability, and probably should in my view, to providing they can come up with reasonable arguments and evidence, to depict the historical figures they're talking about in a particular way. But I think that's probably the only element that the two genres really have in common. So it remains to be seen whether I will be successful going down that route. And if I am, I plan to write something in a completely different era, to go back to the medieval time, and perhaps write a series of books about queens of England who are largely forgotten, but who you know, make rather good fictional material. So that's where I am at the moment.
That sounds really interesting. I was actually planning to ask you what you were going to write next, but
you've already answered that, so...
I have to some degree. I mean, I do have a proposal that my agent is currently putting forward to other publishers for a book on the last days of Marie Antoinette, which would start with the Revolution of August the 10th and cover the last 14 months of her life. And I would like to write that, but in the current circumstances, it presents certain challenges. I mean, you can do a lot of stuff digitally now. You can order documents from the Archives Nationales because, you know, even when these places reopen, it won't necessarily be that easy to go there because of travel restrictions, health restrictions and all that. You know, both my husband and myself have underlying health conditions and we're not going to rush out anywhere, basically, until they have a vaccination for this ghastly virus. So, and yes, of course, you can order things online, but there's often a long waiting time. And it's not the same as being there in person, I don't think. Because when you are in somewhere like the Library of Congress or the archives here at Kew or the Archives Nationales, some of the importance of it is that finding things there that lead from one thing to another. And that's much more difficult to do if you're ordering individual documents online. So I think it robs you of that kind of spontaneity, you know, if you're actually in archives doing research. But I haven't ruled that out, and indeed neither is my agent, but this is a dismal time, actually, for trying to sell nonfiction. My agent himself is a writer, and he recently said that, you know, his work as a literary agent has virtually dried up now.
That's actually really interesting. I've read a lot about, like, literary agents getting actually quite a spike in the number of submissions.
Well, I'm not sure either, because I think it's a bit of both. But I think what's happening with it is that, I mean, nobody really knows. You think you know your publisher quite well, but all you really know is your editor and your publicist there. As a writer, you have no idea what their finances are. I mean, they keep these sort of things very close to their chest for understandable reasons. And I think what a lot of particularly would-be writers and perhaps young academics don't quite realise is that publishing is a business. And it doesn't matter how good your idea is or even how good you are as a writer. And you may be enthusiastically supported by your editor. My editor, for example, loved my proposal for the book on Marie Antoinette, but she couldn't get people inside to go with her. And if the salespeople, whether rightly or wrongly, decide it isn't going to sell, then you've had it. You know, it will not go ahead. And I have forgotten the number of times I've sat next to people at sort of literary lunches and dinners. There is an organisation here called the Biographers Club. There's a similar one in the US, actually. And you sit next to people who say, oh, you know, my great aunt Gertie left me a bag full of interesting letters from the war, and I'm going to write a book. And you think, no, you are not. Or at least, if you are, you probably aren't going to get it published, because that isn't how publishing works. So you do learn a lot as you go through the process, I think. And it is very hard, you know, if it's hard for agents to be selling established authors now, it's much, much harder for those who've never published at all. So I have sort of heard contradictory things as well, my editor said, oh, we are actively looking for new acquisitions. So what happens? You send them one and they say, no, thank you. So there is probably something else going on behind all of this, I think. And only time will tell. But you're right, Maggie, it may be that it's more for fiction than non-fiction.
This is really interesting, actually, because I guess the sales element of publishing then kind of distorts what types of history get told.
Yes, it does. It's a powerful factor in the puzzling to many of us as historians and enduring appeal of the Tudors. Because what happens is that the same topics are covered again and again and again and again. It's quite possible that if I put forward an idea for writing a biography of Anne Boleyn, someone would snap it up, even though there's nothing new to say about Anne Boleyn. And it's been said probably a lot better by other people in the past. I mean, the other thing that happens here, though, I really don't know whether it's similar in the States or in other parts of the world, is that there's been a bit of a burgeoning of sort of, this is going to sound unkind, but kind of second-rate publishers, you know, who offer people a pittance for the book and produce a rather badly edited and illustrated version. And yet again, you find it's something about the youth of Elizabeth I. And I actually don't think this does history or historians any service, really. There appears to be an enduring market for all this kind of stuff. But I mean, I was on a podcast a few days ago for a literary festival here, which of course has now gone virtual, as have all these other things, with a 17th century historian, Paul Lay, who edits the magazine History Today. And he's written about the Cromwellian Protectorate. And we were talking about our book. I was talking about my book on Charles II's mistresses. And we did have a discussion as to why it is that the 17th century is so much the poor relation to the Tudors in the 16th century. And he had an interesting view on this, actually, which on reflection makes a lot of sense. He said, well, in his view, despite what is often said, you know, the Tudors are early modern people, but they're very early modern people. And particularly in the reigns of the early Tudors, the kingship is almost more medieval than it becomes later on. And the people are not so recognisable to us, and therefore perhaps easier to write about in a way. And he said also he thinks the importance of religion in the 17th century, though it was important in the 16th as well, is something that people nowadays find hard to understand. You know, they simply can't comprehend the role that it had in the daily life of people. Now, I have often said about the Tudors that one of the things that most bothers me about the huge popular readership and interest in them is that you do get the impression that many people think the Tudors were just like us, but in fancy dress. And they weren't just like us, of course. They were, in many, many respects, not remotely like us. And religion was important to them as well. Obviously, there were some people who were who only ever paid lip service, I'm sure. But I don't think people living nowadays in a largely secular Western society can understand the importance and all pervasiveness of religion in people's daily lives, and the importance of ideas like providence, which was vital during the civil wars in the 17th century. And they're not very interested in the spread of new ideas. So if you can focus on Henry VIII's six wives, then you somehow, although you shouldn't, of course, ignore these other aspects, you can mostly get away with it. It may be, funnily enough, that you've hit on perhaps the snag with my book that I wanted to write on the last days of Marie Antoinette, that it is the French Revolution. And one thing that I think should give anyone pause is that, I mean, I know a number of people who work in TV and film and all that sort of thing, because every time you bring out a book, there is an attempt to try and sell it. And there has actually been quite a lot of interest from TV and film people in my book Mistresses, but whether any of this will translate into TV and film rights, I personally doubt, though I would like to be proved wrong for obvious reasons. A friend of mine who is a very experienced and competent TV producer and scriptwriter had taken an idea for a series on Marie Antoinette to the BBC here, and was told by the relevant commissioning editor that we are the British Broadcasting Corporation and we don't make programmes about French queens. And which was an ignorant remark, because of course Marie Antoinette was actually Austrian, but you know, I suppose we all know what he meant. And that isn't an apocryphal story, incidentally. So, you know, there is a huge upwards battle to be fought, I suppose. Funnily enough, there's been a bit more interest in the book on Marie Antoinette in the US thus far. It hasn't translated into anything yet, but there has been some interest. Because I think she is a big name that people know there, whereas we were told in no uncertain terms that nobody is remotely interested in Charles II and his mistresses in the US. I mean, these are all very finite things. And, you know, you have to remind yourself when you run into the inevitable stumbling blocks that all writers do. And I suppose I've been lucky over the last 15 years not to run into one until now. But you know, you have to remind yourself that 17 publishers rejected J.K. Rowling before she became world famous. So I think the thing that always intrigues and annoys writers is that they're all totally unapologetic and unembarrassed about this sort of thing. It's just water off a duck's back and they go on to the next thing.
You've just released a new book, which you mentioned, and it's received lots of wonderful reviews, Mistresses, Sex and Scandal at the Court of Charles II. So could you talk a bit about the book? What is it about exactly?
Yes, it's about not all of Charles's mistresses, because there are some fairly minor ones who I refer to in passing in the book. But essentially, it's a book about the women that Charles was closest to, and it looks at their lives in a sort of chronological progression, starting with Lucy Walter, who was briefly his mistress when he was in exile in The Hague, and who was the mother of his eldest illegitimate son, the Duke of Monmouth. She may have conveniently died off quite early, even before he was restored, but the problem with the son, of course, never went away and would grow worse and worse during Charles's reign. And then I go on to look at Barbara Villiers, who becomes Barbara Palmer, the Countess of Castlemaine, a woman absolutely renowned for her financial greed and sexual voracity. I think the nicest thing one can say about Barbara is that she was a very passionate woman. There are some other much more unkind things that people did say at the time. One of the things that struck me about writing the book was how very much in the public eye these women were, often because they sought to be, because celebrity was important then as it is now. But how this left you open to the most scurrilous and often revolting of sort of pamphlets, rhymes, criticism and all that sort of thing. You know, if these ladies had had Twitter accounts, they would have had a lot of trolls, I think. Certainly she would, at any rate. From Barbara, I go on to look at the that Queen Catherine, Catherine of Braganza, who was probably the only woman that ever really loved Charles, in a sort of genuine and selfless way. And she's often written off in this country and elsewhere, I think, is a kind of weepy dope who was sort of not particularly attractive. The king never really had any interest in her, and she took refuge in the Catholic religion and sort of just lived very quietly. But actually, she's a much more interesting woman than that. She came as a bride with an enormous dowry, the richest of any bride of queen consort of whoever came to this country, because Portugal had huge possessions in South America, what's now Brazil, in India and in the Far East. And Charles II was always desperately short of money, and she brought a lot with her. But she couldn't have children. She had three pregnancies and lost each of the children. And she, again, as I said just now, you know, you would be surprised, quite taken aback, I think, by the sort of things that were in common discussion in those days. You know, I cannot imagine, certainly from Queen Victoria onwards, and perhaps quite a lot before that, huge public discussion of you know, a queen's menstrual cycle. But this was the kind of thing that Catherine of Braganza had to put up with. She does appear to have had a condition which causes you to hemorrhage a great deal. Much more than is natural. And apparently it's unusual to be able to bring children to term. in pregnancies under those circumstances. You can conceive, but you tend to lose the children. And that's what happened to poor Catherine of Braganza. But I mean, all of this is quite widely known and written about all over Europe. You know, there's this poor woman with a philandering and often unpleasant husband. Some people have said, oh, but you know, Charles didn't divorce her, which is true. He didn't divorce her, but he didn't really treat her very well. He was quite brutal to her when he forced his mistress, Lady Castlemaine, onto Catherine as one of her, the ladies of her bedchamber. And eventually, by the time that Catherine had lost her third pregnancy, I think they both decided that she wouldn't perhaps be ever able to have any children. And at that point, she started to establish a quite different sort of life for herself. I mean, she was well enough off financially, of course. She was in a privileged position. She began to sponsor, you know, musicians who were to her taste, artists who were very definitely not French, because she disliked Louise de Kerouac, the king's most important politically mistress. And she forged a quite separate sort of lifestyle for herself, and she introduced tea drinking to the United Kingdom, Great Britain as it then was, as a very important social pastime, as opposed to some nasty medicinal drink, which was what people thought it was before then. And she brought with her, of course, a lot of the sort of furnishings from the Far East, which had been part of her court at Lisbon. So lots of sort of wicker work, beautiful rugs, ornate furniture and things of that sort. And she managed to get along quite well, and eventually, of course, outlived Charles and finally went back to Portugal, where she was a very competent regent for a short period of time. So she's an interesting and often overlooked figure. But I suppose, I think there are two of his mistresses, Charles's mistresses, that I found perhaps more interesting than the others. One is someone who was never actually physically his mistress. There wasn't for want of trying on Charles's part. And that is the, she was an extremely distant relative, Frances Teresa Stuart, who was the daughter of royalist exiles brought up in Louis XIV's court in France, who was sent over by Minette, Charles II's youngest and most favoured relative, to adorn his court and also to be a maid of honour to Catherine of Braganza at the age of 15. And for 5 years, you know, Charles tried desperately to get this young woman into his bed and poured her publicly and all that kind of thing, until I think she realised, you know, this can't go on. And she eloped with his cousin. He happened to be a cousin that Charles didn't like at all, so it wasn't it was perhaps in one way a rash thing to do, but this marriage proved very affectionate. Frances Teresa became an extremely competent manager of her husband's estates and affairs, though he was hugely in debt. He died. He was the Duke of Richmond and Lennox, so she did get a nice title out of it. She might, you know, a title to which when she was born she certainly wouldn't have ever had any thought of receiving, I think. But her husband died in a bizarre boating accident when he was ambassador to Copenhagen. She was childless and she had to fight to retain parts of his estate that he'd willed to her and all that sort of thing. And she managed to do this very successfully and lived on into the reign of Queen Anne. So she was a clever survivor as well. And I think the mistress that a lot of people haven't heard of but have become very interested in is Hortense Mancini, who was born Hortensia Mancini in Rome and was the niece of Cardinal Mazarin, the French minister who was such an important politician during the minority of Louis XIV. And she is a remarkable woman with an amazing life. It was just hugely dramatic. You couldn't make it up, really. She married an depressive obsessive and had several children with him before running away. And he'd kept hold of most of her jewels and things that she owned. And she roamed throughout Europe and eventually settled in England. where she became briefly Charles II's mistress. She was his last mistress. But she stayed here, living here as the muse of another exiled French philosopher, and drinking far too much, as it turned out. She died in debt, and her bill for gin was really quite extraordinary. And you do find these nice little things when you're researching in private archives. But she was very beautiful, bisexual, as far as we can tell. She had affairs with women as well as men. And she was one of the five beautiful nieces of Cardinal Mazarin. Several people have said to me on Twitter, you know, but her life story and that of her sisters would make a marvellous TV programme, which it would. But again, they're French, they're foreign, so we don't want to know about them here in the UK. And I don't see much change about that sort of thing in the immediate future. But it was a fun book to write, I think. I did some research in private archives, which is always good, you know, in the private archives of Barbara Palmer's family, which are close to Windsor, and in the papers of the Duke of Richmond, which are now in the West Sussex Record Office. So it was an interesting and fun book to write. And I suppose at the heart of it as well is Charles II himself, who I think, with one or two exceptions, those of us who've written about him end up disliking him quite a lot. And he was a deeply flawed man. I don't think anyone ever really knew him. I'm not sure whether he ever really knew himself, actually. He was obviously intelligent, but lazy. He's not really like Henry VIII, because of course he makes Henry VIII's private life look quite puritanical in comparison. He doesn't seem to have cared about what people thought about him. His court was a byword for hedonism and immorality. His reign was disastrous for Great Britain in foreign affairs. Two awful wars with the Dutch that we lost, including one which led to the burning of the British fleet in Chatham. When the Dutch fleet came up the River Medway and destroyed it. He made a secret treaty with Louis XIV, his cousin, in 1670, in which he essentially sold his country to Louis in return for money. Now, it's true he didn't do anything that he said he would do in that treaty, but it is an enormous betrayal by a monarch. I don't think there's anything else like it in British history at all. On the other hand, unlike Henry VIII, although he wasn't necessarily loyal to his ministers and tended to play them off against one another, Charles II never actually beheaded any of them, and he didn't divorce his wife. He had an heir in his brother James, possibly the least favourite of his siblings, but the one thing that Charles did have, which gives him a point of commonality with other monarchs of the time, and indeed with the Tudors, I suppose, is the belief in legitimate descent. Much as his illegitimate son Monmouth and those surrounding Monmouth agitated and tried to get James, Duke of York, removed from the succession in the succession crisis of 1679 to 81, they didn't succeed, and James did succeed his brother, though only for 3 years. He was a disaster. And Charles's reign is also a complicated one. And despite the sort of image of the merry monarch and what fun this must all have been, it wasn't fun if you were a dissenter, whether a radical Protestant or a Catholic. And Charles actually ruled a deeply divided country. And of course, he never set foot while king in either Ireland or Scotland. He had set foot in Scotland as a would-be king with disastrous results. And he never liked the place and never went there again. So it's an important period in our history, which people overlook. It sees the beginning of the two-party system during the succession crisis. And I tried to convey some of the complexity of it against the backdrop of the lives of the seven women that I cover in my book.
So I wanted to ask you about Charles's mistresses, as you've kind of said, were quite a diverse group of women. And I'm curious about how have you approached this in light of the one common trait of them being Charles's mistresses, despite them having these all these very diverse backgrounds?
I suppose the underlying attempt was to try and assess how much political influence they had. That varies a great deal from woman to woman. And I suppose the overriding conclusion that I drew at the end of it is that certainly Louise de Querouel, the French woman who was Charles's mistress for much of the last 15 years of his life, really, was perceived by politicians at the time to have influence. But whether she did or not is quite another matter. She certainly thought she had, but it's very difficult to connect any decision that Charles made or didn't make to her. He did listen to some of the things that she said about individual people in terms of appointments to various offices, but that's not really the same as having a sort of underlying and widespread political influence. I suppose the other thing that I took away from writing about the book is that for most people, the only one of his mistresses they've ever heard of really is Nell Gwynne. And in many respects, she's the least significant politically. She wasn't particularly interested in politics. She did try and improve Charles's relationships with the Duke of Monmouth when they got quite difficult. And certainly the Duke of Buckingham, who was, again, not as important a figure as he would like to have thought he was, tried to use Nell Gwynne to see if she could influence Charles II. But really, Nell's problem, I think, was that she came from a quite different social class from the other mistresses, even from Frances Teresa Stuart, whose father was connected to the royal Stuarts and was the part of a junior branch of the Blantyre family in Scotland. But while we always think of Nell Gwynne as selling oranges and being an actress, and indeed she was apparently a very good comedy actress, not so good as a tragedian, I gather. But she really wasn't and wouldn't have been viewed at the time as a person of great influence. She had a larger-than-life personality and was obviously very amusing to know, but she was never really accepted at court. They thought that she was lower class and vulgar, which she was. and the fact that she'd managed to get where she was says a great deal for her personality and perseverance, I think. But it always struck me as a bit odd that the one mistress that most people would say that they'd heard of is actually probably nowhere near the most significant of Charles II's mistresses. And in writing about them, I tried to tell their story largely in chronological order of the way that they came into Charles II's life. I mean, admittedly, there is some overlap with that. It's unavoidable. But I think it was to try and show how a group of women become celebrities of a different age and how they try and demonstrate and hold on to that celebrity, whether it's through supporting painters, through making sure that their movements and what they're doing is known to diarists and other influencers. It's like celebrity now, but practiced in a rather different way.
And so you've kind of touched on these women lived through quite a tumultuous time in English history that was fraught with religious and political division, sort of on the cusp of economic modernization as well. How did this context play into their relationships with Charles?
I'm not sure it did, really. I think it was largely an irrelevance, except perhaps in the case of Louise de Querouel, who got herself horribly embroiled in the succession crisis in the late 1670s. and, you know, firstly didn't support the Duke of Monmouth, and then did, and then realised that that was a mistake and sort of veered to and fro, and did give support to different politicians. But beyond that, I think what was happening in English politics and in English society was going on at a level completely removed from Charles's relationships with these women. I mean, as well as it being a disastrous time for foreign policy, you have the Great Plague of 1665, the Great Fire of 1666, and numerous sort of problems with bad harvests, the Little Ice Age and all that sort of thing. But I don't think that that what was going on in society had a great deal to do with Charles's personal relationships. I think he kept them really quite compartmentalised from his political life.
Of the five books you've written, four of them are about the lives of women. And as you said, especially among Charles's mistresses, sort of the history has been written by people who didn't really approve of them. So how have you gone about sort of recovering the truth, so to speak, of these women's lives?
Well, mostly by looking at original sources, I suppose, and also trying to stand back from what's been written about them in the past. Apart from one or two books on Barbara Palmer, it is quite curious that people who've written about Charles's mistresses in the past have all been men. And I'm the first woman to write a kind of composite history of them, if you like. But basically, you do it just by sort of looking at the individual lives and trying to find what is interesting and appealing in it, and perhaps to contrast what would have struck people at the time with what might strike people now. But you also have, unlike for the Tudor period, for this period you have an almost embarrassment of riches in terms of sources. You've got lots of diaries, letters, accounts. I mean, like all things in history, you have to remember that they're quite often written from a specific viewpoint to try and push certain ideas or certain interpretations. But you have got a great deal of material, and you do have the opportunity to look at them, I think, both through the eyes of people who saw them at the time and through perhaps more modern eyes, and to see if you can produce a picture which does them justice in the times in which they lived, but is also interesting to people who might want to read about them now.
On that subject, you also mentioned earlier sort of the conflict surrounding the succession and the Duke of Monmouth. So I'm wondering, what would you say are the legacies of Charles's mistresses within the bigger picture of English history?
That's a good question. I think their legacy is perhaps not much more than to be remembered as, in most cases, beautiful. Because unlike Henry VIII's wives, few of whom can actually, if any, can actually be described as beautiful, these were by and large good-looking, handsome women. To be remembered as the sort of it girls of their time, really. To be associated with a man who's still viewed as perhaps, whether justifiably or not, really the only competent Stuart monarch, and to be representatives of a time of great excess. And I think that appeals to people, actually. Funnily enough, it does seem to have appealed to people in the current times that we live in now, where people are looking for diversion and entertainment. To be honest, I have been quite surprised by the interest in my book and the success of it thus far. And you never know. That's what's so interesting about being a writer and being published. But I think the fact that these women are remembered at all, and they are, you know, though perhaps some of them are much more well-known than others, it is part of a yearning for a colourful past, which contrasts with some of the way that we live now, and which people can be sort of interested in and read more about without having to go into the detail of the more complex political and social things that were going on at the same time. I mean, they, in a way, they lived sort of charmed lives and have continued in a kind of rarefied sphere. If you learn anything about Charles II from them and studying them, I think it is just how difficult he is to understand, quite honestly.
On the subject of Charles being difficult to understand, I mean, you've mentioned sort of he lived this life of excess while at the same time being quite a ruler with questionable skills. What was sort of his private life to him in the context of all his political struggles? Was it sort of an escape, you might say?
Yes, I'm no doubt it was. I think it was quite important. You know, people have often wondered why he paraded his illegitimate children. There's some dispute as to how many he actually had, probably because we don't know, and a lot of people count in Barbara Palmer's last daughter, who was almost certainly fathered by John Churchill, later Duke of Marlborough. But Charles had more than a dozen illegitimate children that we know of. One interpretation is that he didn't attempt to hide them because they were a sign of the fact of his virility. You know, it wasn't his fault that he couldn't father a legitimate child. It showed that he was perfectly able to father children. It's just that he couldn't have any with his poor, unfortunate wife. He is a difficult man to get to know, I think, and a harder man to like. But I think he lived the way he did because he could. And he hadn't been able to in exile. You know, part of understanding Charles, I'm sure, though it might be possible to overstress it in a way, is to consider what happened to him as a youth and then a young man. You know, when the Civil War broke out, his education was effectively ended. And he doesn't seem to have been a particularly apt or intellectually curious pupil even before that. But he didn't have much instruction after that time, although he could, if he paid much attention, have learnt a lot about politics and how to manage men from Edward Hyde, who became Earl of Clarendon. He had competent enough people around him, but he also had huge numbers of hangers-on. But I think the period of his exile did mark him for life. I mean, it's one of the truisms of English history that Charles II was determined never to go on his travels again. But he was determined never to. And he had lived as a pensioner and the poor relation of his Bourbon relatives in Paris. He'd had to pay, didn't very much, but his mother had desperately wanted him to marry his ghastly vain cousin, La Grande Mademoiselle, in front of whom he conveniently forgot all his French. Because he could speak foreign languages, incidentally. He was apparently pretty fluent in French, Spanish and Italian. So he wasn't an incompetent man, but he had spent, 15 years basically, 13 years very nearly as a monarch in exile. And he had no money, and he'd been looked down upon and had to move around. He'd had quarrelsome courtiers trying to live off him when he had nothing to give them. I think once he returned to England, and even bearing in mind that he didn't actually have anything like the money that he would have wanted because Parliament consistently refused to vote it to him, still he was able to get his hands on more money than he'd ever had before. And he lavished it on himself and his mistresses because that was what he wanted to do. So I think he lived that way because he was a lazy, pleasure-loving man, but he had enough political ability and sort of enough strategic sense to know how to play the system as it then was in England and how to remain king. And in fact, of course, for the last 4 years of his life, his reign, he ruled without a parliament, perhaps hoping to bury to sort of base himself on what his cousin was doing in France, though I don't think he would have succeeded even if he'd lived longer. I think he would have run into financial and political difficulties that would have resurrected themselves again. But I think his lifestyle was representative of someone who had had a very checkered background, and who wanted to demonstrate that if you can live in luxury and with low morals and be king, you can get away with it.
What it seems to me is that Charles's exile kind of foreshadowed the death of the monarchy, or created that by making Charles into quite an unpopular monarch. Would you say that that's sort of the chain of causation?
Yes, I suppose I would, actually. I mean, the monarchy, of course, survived after James II, but in a form which perhaps was implicit in the civil wars. Charles had managed to restore the importance of the Church of England, and that would continue under Queen Anne, and perhaps acquire even more importance. And he'd managed to hold on to the Stuart dynasty. Whether if he'd behaved any differently, the monarchy would have taken a different shape or form, I don't really know. I mean, the problem, of course, with James II wasn't just his religion, the Catholicism, but the way he went about actually ruling and the relationship he would have tried to put in place between the church and the state, which did remind people of why there had been a parliamentary revolt back in the 1640s, I think. So Charles II's reign is not entirely an aberration. Perhaps it is a step on a road to what began in the 1640s. And it's always seemed to me that the civil wars did change this country quite profoundly over a long period of time. Even if you can turn around and say, well, the monarchy was restored and look at the way Charles II behaved. But I think there were profound changes which Charles perhaps recognised in the undercurrents of things that were going on in his country. He thought if he could cling on for long enough, he could ride them out. And of course he did.
With that, I want to go back a few years in your career and in English history and ask about your previous book, Royal Renegades, which is about the children of Charles I. It offers quite a different lens into the life of Charles I and his son, Charles II. So I'm wondering sort of what did the English Civil War look like through this lens?
Well, I think it's difficult when you write about the Civil Wars to divorce yourself from what you personally feel about them and what came out of them, which is true, I think, of any revolutionary era. I mean, it's difficult to do that as well in the French Revolution. I thought that looking at the children of Charles II would perhaps broaden people's views of what happened during the Civil Wars, because what happened to the royal family is in many respects highly typical of what happened to many other families at the time, that they were divided in geography, in religion, because some were Catholic and some were Protestant, that they reacted to what happened to them in ways which would shape them permanently in the future. I actually enjoyed writing Royal Renegades a great deal. It was quite a challenging book, because to try and represent what was happening in the Civil War through the lives of the royal family, the royal children, is actually not an easy thing to do. But I think if anything, it shows what a fundamentally important event it was, and why I and other historians now working in the 17th century feel, I guess, somewhat aggrieved that it's really no longer taught even in British schools anymore. And people think that it's too difficult because it deals a lot with ideas. But in the lives of those children of Charles I, you can actually see how the Civil War affects a person's life, their health, their chances, their view of who they are or I suppose even. So to that degree, I suppose that was the kind of lens I was trying to put on it, to demonstrate to people that, you know, we know a lot of things about battles, and we understand the sort of major divisions of the Civil War, we think we do. But what we lose, I think, in not studying it very much anymore is the richness of the period and the way it has helped shape our national life. Because we did execute a king. And centuries later, poor Louis XVI in France would read avidly about what happened to Charles I and see in it, especially in the last few months of his life, an exact pointer as to what was going to happen to him. And I know a lot of people think, oh, well, you know, if you look at the way the monarchy has survived, what did change? But I think people's view of the how they related to monarchy, or at least how there could be other power structures. You know, the importance of Parliament grew very greatly. And the kind of religious divisions, which lasted well into the 19th century, of course, before Catholic emancipation, were also begun during that period of the Civil Wars. But if you look at what actually happened to the children, of course, Charles and James and Princess Henrietta, the youngest child, all became Catholic, although Henrietta was baptised at Exeter Cathedral as a Protestant, but her mother brought her up in France against Charles I's wishes as a Catholic. Charles II converted to Catholicism on his deathbed, but probably been, insofar as he was remotely religious at all, been attracted to it for some time before then. James converted in the late 1660s, early 1670s, partly encouraged by his wife, Anne Hyde. Elizabeth and Henry, who were left behind, of course, as hostages, essentially, to the parliamentarians, were both brought up and raised and were committed Protestants. In fact, that's what separated Henry from his mother, very sadly, when he eventually was allowed to leave in the early 1650s and go to join her in France. So they are, they in their own lives, it seems to me, epitomised some of the differences that grew during the Civil War and would, over a long period of time afterwards, sort of play out in English political and religious history.
You write more for a general audience, but I think your approach could be also valuable for academic history. I'm just wondering, like, what is sort of the value of writing this different brand of history?
Well, it's to make history interesting and perhaps more immediate to a general audience, while at the same time perhaps producing stuff that can be used by a more academic one. I am fairly unusual amongst people writing for a more general audience in having an academic background. Quite a lot of people do and do it successfully, but a number of people haven't. And I think there is a bit of a divide between us. But I think what will be useful for a more academic audience is perhaps to look at the way historians like myself write for a wider public. And see what they can find in that, which is useful for their own researches and interests, because sometimes you can pick out certain aspects of it, which from an academic point of view might be more interesting to follow. I will now try and think of an example for that. I mean, you can, one of the areas of the Civil War that has become interesting for people to explore. It is the sort that was demonstrated by the historian John Adamson when he wrote about the Noble Revolt. You know, that's a huge book. It's a very, very long book. And it's peppered with footnotes. I don't think I've ever read a book that has quite so many footnotes as that. I mean, about the last third of it is footnotes. But nevertheless, it deals with an important topic in an interesting way for both the academic world and the more popular one, and trying to achieve that kind of balance isn't easy. I suppose in my books that I wrote on the Tudors, particularly with my first book on Mary Tudor, I tried to demonstrate that there had been a whole area of academic research going on for several decades now, 20 to 30 years, which had not, and perhaps sadly still has not, found its way into the general interpretation of one of English history's most contentious and disliked monarchs. I think one of the things that people like myself can do, and which I always try to do in the books I write, is to demonstrate what the latest scholastic thinking is, and to interpret it and synthesize it in a way that can be understood by a wider public. I do think there is still a considerable divide between academics who are writing largely for themselves and other academics, and I understand that that is a necessary part of the whole university life. It is what you need to do. But nevertheless, I don't think it's so prevalent now, but I think in the past there was a tendency to sort of look down on people who were historians but who wrote more popular histories, and particularly on biographers, incidentally, which has dissipated somewhat now. And I do think that the academic world has realised that for its own survival, it may be necessary to try and present the research that it's doing in a more digestible form, because that will feed back into grants and you know, further publications and things of that sort. However, it is terribly difficult to change popular views. Well, I suppose Mary Tudor is a case in point. And I recently did a review of a book by Alexander Sampson, whom I've known for some years actually, on the marriage of Mary Tudor and Philip of Spain. And I didn't know until I read that book, partly because I haven't been to Madrid in a good few years perhaps, that there is a metro station in Madrid called Queen Mary the First. Can you imagine what would happen in the UK if anyone dared to suggest that you called a London Underground station after Bloody Mary? You know, there would be, Twitter would be taken by storm. It would be amazing. And yet, you know, for many years, there was a lot of academic research done on Mary, which simply did not filter out into to the general public. And my view as someone who has been on both sides of this divide is that I have a duty to represent the latest scholarship and the latest academic research in a way that is interesting for people and marry it in with my own. But that academics have a duty not to sit all the time in ivory towers. And if they want to really change the way that history is viewed, then they have to come down off the pedestal a bit and not sit all the time writing obscure monographs on things. And even now you can see it on Twitter, you know, and I admire these people hugely. You know, my book on blah blah is just published and you think, and it'll be read by all of a dozen people. I mean, sure, it'll be in libraries and things like that. Of course it is important, and people should still continue doing it. But I think the disdain that the academic world used to have for people who tried to make history more accessible is receding, and I hope it recedes still further.
With that, thank you so much. It's been a privilege speaking to you.
Well, thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of On History, a podcast from the Oxford University History Society. Remember to come back next week to hear from Ian Mortimer, acclaimed historian and author of the Time Traveler's Guide series.